supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Joe Hernandez, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off. More than a year ago, Delaware Governor John Carney called for a school policy to protect students from discrimination, particularly transgender kids. But the proposal was met with fierce opposition from some parents. Now the Carney administration is backpedaling and scrapping the idea, at least for the moment. From the Delaware desk, WHYY's Chris Barish reports.
The policy's first version would have allowed transgender students to use a different name at school without notifying their parents. Carney's team backed off that provision in June after receiving 11,000 emails, most in opposition. But foes were still unhappy with the next draft, which allowed students to use the bathroom and locker room matching their gender identity. Now Carney is shelving Regulation 225 and said he's mulling his, quote, next steps. Teacher Andrea Rashbaum, mother of a transgender student and member of the panel that drafted the policy, was not surprised.
They didn't want to go against the masses. I really believe that Carney wanted to move the ball forward. When the 11,000 emails came out, he realized that the ball was in a tornado somewhere, and he didn't know what to do about that tornado.
Nicole Tice, who heads the Delaware Family Council, is pleased the proposal is dead for now, but she knows another fight may be looming.
Regulation 225 calls the school system to be pitted against parental authority and a gender ideology against a right to privacy. So the only way to strike a balance is for the school administration to have the flexibility to seek reasonable accommodations that protect both the dignity and the privacy of all students.
Rashbaum and other LGBTQ advocates are drawing hope, however, from a May ruling that Carney cited from the U.S. Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia. The court, which has jurisdiction over Delaware, upheld the right of a Boyertown, Pennsylvania high school to let transgender students choose their bathroom and locker room.
Now, if the school districts are sued and it goes all the way to the circuit court, our circuit court, the transgender kids will win if their rights have not been protected.
Carney wouldn't elaborate on his next steps, but the interested parties will be waiting. From the Delaware desk, Chris Barish, WHYY News.
A new policy in Pennsylvania means the state's medical marijuana patients can now get the drug in dry leaf form. NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller decided to check in on how the American public was feeling about marijuana with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll.
Although medical marijuana only is available in Pennsylvania, there does seem to be this growing sense that states are embracing even recreational marijuana. Where do attitudes stand on it at this juncture?
Well, medical marijuana is a no-brainer. For a number of years now, we've been finding in other pollsters 75% plus of Americans say yes to legalizing marijuana for medical uses, as in Pennsylvania. But the big change in attitudes has been the increase in support for legalizing marijuana in general, we might say for recreational use. Our latest update, 64%. We don't have to go back too far in time to find 12% who favored legalizing it. That was back in 1969. But even as recently as 1996, it was only 25%, and it really only broke through the 50% barrier over the last 5 or 10 years. So we clearly have a majority, in fact, almost two-thirds of Americans now, Dave, who say yes to doing what states like Colorado and Massachusetts and others have done, and that is to legalize recreational marijuana.
Why don't we stay on the topic of consumables? What do you know about Dunkin' Donuts?
Well, recently, Dunkin' Donuts, in fact, this week, announced their first gluten-free product. How's that? So that led us to say, well, I wonder how many Americans are really attempting to eat gluten-free. And we found a higher percent than you might imagine. The number is up to about 20-21% who say yes. They try to include gluten-free foods in their diet.
In a more general sense, how many Americans say they are consciously trying to eat healthy?
Well, Americans are aware of what nutrition experts would tell them about what they should be eating, even if they don't do it.
Frank, let's turn to politics, and specifically President Donald Trump's poll numbers.
President Trump tweeted, quote, "Wow, highest poll numbers in the history of the Republican Party. That includes Honest Abe Lincoln and Ronald Reagan."
Was Gallup or other pollsters at it back in the days of Abraham Lincoln?
Well, they weren't. But we do wonder what he was talking about. Other people have looked at this as well. Highest poll numbers in the history of the Republican Party. Now, does that mean highest overall poll numbers? Does that mean the highest number among Republicans? And does that mean the highest at this point, a year and a half into his administration? Or does it mean the highest across all the other Republicans' entire administration since Eisenhower when we first started polling?
Is it a true statement in any of those metrics?
I would have to say no. We can't find real support for this statement. Now, among Republicans, Trump does do well. His approval rating vacillates anywhere from 85 to 88%. In fact, in one weekly poll, we had it up to 90% among Republicans, so that is high. But again, not the highest. Eisenhower, the two Bushes, Richard Nixon, Reagan, all of them had approval ratings at one point or the other in the 90% range, so that's not unusual across an entire president's term. So, putting it all together, we don't find any support, however we look at it, for this statement that the president made or tweeted over the last week or two.
Gallup may not, but does the president cite an alternate polling service to substantiate his contentions?
Well, that's a good question, and I looked that up, and we don't know what he's talking about. We don't know which poll he's referring to. And other people who've written some pieces about this tweet, other people interested in polling, can't find the poll he's referring to either. Our suspicion is that he, watching television, saw somebody reference some poll, probably his rating among Republicans, which, as I mentioned, is quite high in the upper 80s. And in one poll, in one instance, with one comparison standard, maybe somebody said it's the highest in the history of the Republican Party, and that's what he glommed onto and then tweeted. But we don't know exactly which poll he's referring to. And based on our Gallup numbers, which again go back to Dwight Eisenhower, I can't find any substantiation for his tweet.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
Sports are a good way of teaching life lessons. One Wilmington nonprofit has been doing it for 40 years. WHYY's Mark Eichmann has more on how the Rodney Street Tennis and Tutoring Association is courting future leaders.
Opening day for Rodney Street's summer camp earlier this summer was a steamy 92 degrees.
You can't do it, okay? Yes, you can. It's your first.
Instructor Marianne Olmsted doesn't let the heat stop her young players.
We love summer around here, and we are lucky to be the guests of the Tower Hill School. So we're on their complex, and right now, today is the first day, so we're learning all the basics.
Since its founding in 1978, the club has offered tennis lessons and academic tutoring to students in Newcastle County. 2,300 kids take part year-round, while the summer camp hosts about 50 to 60 Wilmington kids each year.
Oh, I think they're looking amazing. Nobody's afraid. Nobody's crying, which is a big thing. Everybody's doing their best. So it looks great. They're having fun. There's smiles on everybody's face.
Youth sports can be too expensive for many families, but 93% of Rodney Street participants qualify for a full or partial scholarship. The group provides shirts and shorts for students, as well as a racket. Tennis was never even on Antoinette Douglas's radar as an activity for her four sons.
I've never thought of tennis. Never, ever crossed my mind. Like I said, and I'm glad that they actually came to my kids' school as a program to allow them to know that, okay, this is available out there.
Her oldest, Joshua, joined the club 5 years ago. The 15-year-old has grown into working as a junior tennis coach.
He gradually increased in his skills of tennis. Forehand especially.
She says all her sons have improved on the court, but maybe more importantly, they've made progress in academics and personal development, especially 14-year-old Michael.
Michael, I don't want to say was one of my problem childs, but Michael was a challenge. And now it's at the point where Michael is not much of a challenge at home because of the tennis program, because it gave him the skills that he needed to be able to deal with opposition and to deal with things that may come his way.
The program got a visit from former tennis player Katrina Adams, who's now serving as the first African-American president of the U.S. Tennis Association. She knows firsthand how programs like Rodney Street can impact lives.
I started in an inner-city program on the west side of Chicago, much like what Rodney Street Tennis Association is. And so I understand the importance of grassroots programs such as this, because my development came from programs like that through Chicago.
Adams said tennis opened doors for her during her appearance at the organization's Spring Gala at the Greenville Country Club near Wilmington earlier this year.
I was very fortunate to have tennis in my life to give me the opportunities to travel the world and to meet some amazing people along the way.
Rodney Street was founded nearly 40 years ago to offer similar opportunities to kids in the Wilmington community, says Executive Director Kareem Bryant.
It was a result of some social things that were going on in and around Wilmington to prevent some violent activities and help kids with some academic enrichment and tutoring.
Bryant says the program has many success stories.
We have a young man this year who's going to be the director of another one of our sites this summer, and he started our program at about this age. He lived in this world where those experiences on the tennis court and in our organization correlated to real life experiences and have helped him become the person he is today.
Bryant hopes to keep growing the program, adding more volunteers to help even more students. From the Delaware Desk, Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
The reassigning of Philadelphia Family Court Judge Lyris Young brought hope to many parents who were separated from their children. They complained Young had treated them unfairly. About half of her rulings have now been overturned by other judges. But the parents say that's just the tip of the iceberg, and they're using the attention on Young to challenge the city's family court system more broadly. For WHYY, Daryl C. Murphy reports.
We need help, family. They're stealing our children. They make up a story and steal our children. They're getting rich off federal money.
Dozens of Philadelphia parents are accusing the Department of Human Services of corruption. Their allegations include falsifying reports and denying them due process. Miltrader Kress of Holmesburg organized dozens of parents who feel the agency took their children unjustly. Her children were taken into custody in September 2017 over abuse and neglect allegations. After their own investigation found there was no abuse, she claims DHS used false reports to prove neglect. Judge Young presided over the case, but has since been sent to another judge.
It is much bigger than Judge Young.
Parents say kids are being kept in foster care even when the family is available to provide a safe home. Some even claim their children are physically and sexually abused while in foster care, with little to no repercussions. Jeff and Virginia McHale say they were unfairly denied custody of their two grandsons by Judge Young. At one point, she even put a restraining order on them. The boys are now in separate foster homes. One child has a developmental disability and the other has already been through five different homes due to abuse. A new hearing is scheduled for September. Virginia says even if she gains custody of her grandson, she will continue to fight.
It's a nightmare. Literally a nightmare. I never thought I would be dealing with this, ever.
DHS issued a statement saying the parents' claims are inaccurate, but cited policy of not addressing specific cases. They reiterated their commitment to child safety and family reunification. The statement also urged disgruntled parents to file a complaint with DHS's Commissioner's Action Response Office, but parents say complaints filed with that office are used against them.
It's not like they're separate from DHS. They call right away and tell your caseworker what you said. They don't keep your investigation separate.
That was Angela Willard. Her children were taken by DHS over abuse allegations. She has been fighting to regain custody of her children for more than a year, even after completing all the requirements ordered by the judge. She, too, faced Young and had a hearing with the new judge. She was again denied. Her attorney, Linda Walters, says too often when abuse or neglect accusations are settled or proven unfounded, parents face another fight to regain their kids.
It's my fear that it's turning into a custody case, not really an abuse case, abuse or neglect. And that's my biggest fear in these cases.
Mayor Jim Kenney's office released an evaluation of the city's child welfare system in October. It found Philadelphia kids are removed from their families almost three times more than the national average. In May, Kenney created the Child Welfare Oversight Board to assess and review DHS. But the oversight board has not enacted policy reforms so far. For WHYY, Daryl C. Murphy.
The annual Black Star Film Festival continues through this weekend in Philadelphia. For 7 years, it's been an African-American beacon on the National Film Festival circuit. This year, HBO chose the festival to launch its new late-night cable TV show called Random Acts of Flyness. WHYY's Peter Crimmins has the story.
Terrence Nance first showed a film at the Black Star Festival in 2012, and he loved it. The New York-based filmmaker made it a point to be in the festival every year since then.
It really just charged me, not just the watching the films, all the conversations that were had around the films, just being in a very black space with people who had a lot of commonality in terms of what we were all grappling with aesthetically and formally and socially.
Nance is launching a new TV show on HBO, Random Acts of Flyness, which people are describing as a dreamscape, as Afro-surrealism. The LA Times called it Gesamtkunstwerk. I had to look that one up. I'll take a stab. It's a stream-of-consciousness variety show that tries to get at what it feels like to be an African-American today.
What up, world? It's Terrence Nance here. Welcome to Random Acts of Flyness. Today we got a whole bunch of flyness.
It opens with Nance riding a bike through Brooklyn, filming himself on his cell phone, introducing the segments coming up on his show.
About white men. I'm trying. Hold on. I'm trying to get.
During this opening monologue, he gets stopped by police.
Damn it.
This confrontation is scripted. It's fiction. But Nance later created a truly disturbing montage of actual violent police encounters captured on cell phones and surveillance cameras. The show is a mashup of humor, of trauma, anger, and sex. Nance says he comes at these vignettes with the emotional distance of an artist.
That kind of amorality is a little bit strange for people who don't do that every day to kind of engage with sometimes. It's like, you put that next to that, you know, like that puts me in a weird space. I think somehow artists are, we're a little bit more allowed, a little bit more, not a lot more, but a little bit more allowed to engage that kind of distance, that emotional distance.
Most TV shows take your hand through their stories. They tell you when something is funny or sad or suspenseful or angry. Random Acts of Flyness has no traffic signs. Everything seems to be happening all at once.
You can't separate the trauma of being a black person in America for sure from like the joy and the musicality and the expressiveness of being a black person in America. And I think that that's something all black people know.
The pilot episode of Random Acts of Flyness debuts on HBO at midnight tonight. The Black Star Film Festival will screen it in advance at 8 o'clock, and maybe the second episode too. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Crossword puzzles can be frustrating, but many people, myself included, love the wordplay and occasional head-scratching that goes along with solving one. Tonight, I'm joined by one of the people who create crosswords. Joel Faliano is a Philly native and the digital puzzles editor at the New York Times. His third book of mini crosswords, published by Macmillan, is coming out next week. Joel, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, Joe.
So you grew up in the Mount Airy section of Philadelphia, and you went to Masterman Middle and High School. Is that where you started getting into crossword puzzles?
Yeah, I actually started to get into crossword puzzles from my dad. He would solve the New York Times crossword every morning with his cup of coffee, and he started to photocopy the puzzles and give them to me for my train ride into Masterman High School. I think like most kids, I was just interested in crosswords. But probably where I diverted from most kids is that then I started to make my own.
And so you then fulfilled the what I imagine is the dream of many crossword creators and got a job at the New York Times. How did that happen?
Yeah, so actually in my senior year when I was at Masterman, I had my first crossword published in the paper. So Will Shortz knew who I was. And so my freshman year of college, I was looking around for a job. I was kind of panicking. It was March or April, and I still didn't have something to do. So I sent him an email and I asked, do you have an intern? And luckily enough, that worked. And I was able to intern with Will Shortz for the following three summers, actually. And really the whole time, I think I thought, well, at some point you'll go and get a real job or you'll find a real industry because crosswords are certainly not a way to make money long term. But then crazily enough, it's worked out that the Times hired me on to help make crossword puzzles.
So you help edit the daily puzzles for the Times, but you also create the 5x5 mini crossword puzzles that are free on the Times website, unlike the daily puzzles, which require a subscription. These mini puzzles have kind of taken off. They're like a sensation now. How did that start?
Well, when the app started in 2014, that was when the Times first launched their own crossword app. And it kind of was tasked to me to come up with something that was on the easier side and perhaps more digitally relevant. And so I came up with a 5x5 crossword. And I try to include some more references that are relevant to daily life. So there might be things from the news or slang that I use that I never see in crossword puzzles but wish was there. I have been accused of being part of the trend that's destroying America, of everything needs to be small and bite-sized and stupid, I guess. But in the way I make the puzzle, I'm still hoping for it to be something that feels rewarding. What I'm trying to do, and it's a hard challenge, is to make something that's quick and consumable, but still sophisticated and interesting.
You mentioned that you get some slang in the puzzle that you don't get in one of the daily puzzles. Have you gotten John in a puzzle yet?
Oh, I've wanted to put John in, but then I keep thinking there it isn't only Philadelphia people who solve this. But, you know, someday I'll cave in and put in John.
A lot of people, I think, believe that the New York Times crossword is way too hard for them and they don't even try it, which I understand. They can be really tough, as I'm sure you understand as well. But what's your advice for those people if you want to convince them to give it a shot and take a stab at doing a Times crossword?
Of course, the best advice I could give is just to solve more crosswords. There's a certain language to crosswords, certain short vowel-heavy words that keep appearing over and over, like, I don't know, Yoko Ono, she's in there all the time, or Brian Eno, he's in there all the time. But also, when I was at Masterman, I would have the puzzle printed out, but a bunch of us would work on it all together. I actually think that's a good way to get into crosswords.
And where do you come down on looking up answers that you just can't figure out?
I'm pro looking up answers. I know there's a stigma against Googling things, but to me, whatever helps you finish the crossword. I mean, really, in the end, it's your puzzle and you should do what you want with it.
So I think some of the people, I mean, I assumed this, that thought that the difficulty behind doing a Times crossword, you know, I needed to have a great vocabulary. I needed to have an encyclopedic knowledge of history in the world. But really, a lot of it comes down to how an answer is clued, right? So a Monday clue will be different than a Thursday clue, and that could be for the same answer.
Exactly. Yes. So one thing a lot of people don't know about the Times crossword is that it ranges in difficulty. So the Monday clues are generally very straightforward. We kind of want the most basic definition. Okay, let's take an example. Say you have the word igloo. A Monday clue might be house made out of ice blocks. Now, let's go throughout the week. So let's say you had a Wednesday or Thursday clue for igloo. We might do something more like Inuit structure. When we get all the way to Saturday, then the puzzle maker and the cluers are actually actively trying to mislead you from getting the answer because they want it to be really hard. A clue might be White House. You're thinking 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. You're thinking, okay, well, maybe right. It's Trump or something. Trump's five letters. But no, the answer is actually igloo because an igloo is a white house.
So we're not all crazy. You guys actually do want to make the Saturdays the most frustrating puzzle we could possibly encounter.
Yes. Yes, we do. Okay. But a lot of people who like the Saturday crossword like it because that sense of real satisfaction of knowing that you bested the hardest puzzle that they could throw at you.
Joel Faliano is the digital puzzles editor at the New York Times and creator and editor of the Times Mini Crossword. Joel, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Binyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. We had production assistance this week from Edward Saakashvili. The news director is Eugene Son. Our assistant news director is Katie Culinary. John Massoni is assistant vice president for news operations. Our engineers this week were Al Banks, Charlie Kyer, Diana Martinez, Adam Stanishevsky, and Mike Villers. Sandra Clark is vice president of news and civic dialogue. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm Joe Hernandez for NewsWorks Tonight.